Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. It is a new decade, and we are your tiny bird under a big blanket of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Say it's a new decade, and yet we're still slightly living in the last decade. We are here in early January, but we are wrapping up our 2019 coverage, looking back at the last 12 months in jazz, and maybe the last 10 years, and maybe the next 10 years. You were just listening to Nikki's Bop. That is on the Tamika Reid Quartet record called Old New, and that is the number one record of 2019, number one jazz record of 2019 from Martin Johnson. Martin's here. What's up, man?
Hello.
Welcome, Martin. I've known Martin for a long time. Haven't seen him in a long time. Martin covers jazz for Jazz Times and the Wall Street Journal. Gio Russinello is here.
What's up, John?
You know Gio from the pages of the New York Times. Gio just coming back tan and fresh and just glowing.
Yeah,
off of a vacation.
Exactly.
came in. So we're going to talk about what's been going on the last 12 months and we are also going to talk as we should do it more than once a year, to be honest, but at least once a year about the bigger movements that are shaping the world of jazz. So we started off with Martin's number one record. Tell me a little bit about this album on a micro aesthetic level and then also bigger picture. What does it represent?
Well, for me, what this album represented was if you wanted to pick one record, and I have other endeavors where people know that I write about jazz, so they'll come and say, what's going on in jazz? If you listen to this record and you wanted to know what was going on in jazz in 2019, this would tell you a lot, because a whole lot of things that have happened gradually over the last many decades are represented in this record. First of all, the ensemble is unusual, but it's very, very lithe, fluid. The guitar player Mary Halverson, who won a MacArthur this year, is on it. Drummer Toma Fujiwara and the bass player Jason Rebke. It's a phenomenal group. They've been together, even though this is only their second record, they have been playing together for 6 or 7 years now. And there's that level of rapport. And also, because it's not a horn and rhythm section type situation, you have a bass, a cello, a guitar, and a drummer, you have a lot of dynamic movement. Sometimes the cello and guitar are out front and the bass and drums are in their customary rhythm role. Sometimes the rhythm is created by guitar and drums and you have bass and cello, maybe arco, maybe not, doing things. It moves all over in terms of who's in the foreground, who's in the background. And it also, as such, it moves very, very organically into group improvisations. So it's not just solo, head that we, you know, come to expect from jazz. It really reflects a lot of thought, a lot of compositional innovation that has gone on in jazz. I mean, there are groups where it's head, solo, an advancement of the head, or something else altogether, you know. And there are these kinds of things that go on in this group. I thought it was really, really representative of it. And I thought it represented a really good presentation of a musician who has been a vital part of both the New York and Chicago scenes for almost 20 years now. Tamika Reid, I think, is building toward that moment where she gets kind of within the demi-monde of jazz some sort of universal recognition as a phenomenal player, a, you know, for lack of a better word, the genius that she is.
Gio, this record resonate for you?
Oh, humongously. I completely agree with everything Martin's saying, and I feel like there's that element of not indetermination, but just disoriented, transcendent listening that you can get into when, as you mentioned, the instrumentation's a little unusual. the roles that each instrument is being invited to play are super broadly defined. So you're listening to an album of sound, but that's about all you know, right? So then you just have to say, okay, I buy in, do what you're going to do. I don't have many expectations. What's this going to do for me? You know, and what it turns out that this record does is it quickens your pace. It really, like, kind of seizes you. It's rhythm all through and through. It's also the texture and the grain of the instruments. I mean, it's acoustic music very, very much. You hear and feel the cello for all of its capabilities, whether she's playing pizzicato, whether she's playing arco, you know, walking a line and then taking that walked line and making it arrhythmic. There's so many different directions you can go. What's beautiful is that it's firmly, firmly ensconced in the present, because you wouldn't have these rhythms necessarily exactly as they are 30 or 40 years ago in American music. But there's an ancient quality to it. I relate this a lot to the kinds of hip-hop that we hear from more lo-fi producers like Madlib, like Roz G, who we lost last year, who themselves are doing a sort of ancient thing that's very much about everything is, in that James Brown way, a rhythm instrument, but it's also got a texture and a grain and a melody element to it, maybe, whether it's the cello or the guitar or the bass, or in the case of Roz G, some kind of exploding, you know, ambiguous sound that is more than just rhythm.
Can I ask a sort of naive question? Because I feel like this is a thing that I thought a lot about a lot in the 90s as far as feedback loops between the jazz ecosystem and the hip-hop ecosystem. And I feel like they were heavy for a long time. They kind of faded, at least coming from my perspective, which is the outsider perspective.
Oh, yeah, and I think you're right.
And for those who are listening, and if you're the type of podcast listener that doesn't like to hear me talk, this is going to be a great episode for you.
Are there any of those?
Yeah, there's like one, I think. I got an email. There was like one. So I don't know what to say about that first. But anyway, this is your episode. Are those feedback loops, are they stronger now? And if so, are they functioning differently than they did two decades ago?
Well, they're much stronger now. I'm not entirely sure how they are functioning differently. I think I'm not saying I don't know that they are different. I mean, I know that they're different, but I don't know if it's that they're functioning the same in a completely different universe, which is where we're at, or they're functioning different. You know, whether both elements, the time frame and the way they function, are different. I mean, I do think that it's one of these things where if you're a 32-year-old musician in 1995, the odds that you grew up listening to hip-hop are not as potent as you
as
they
now.
Are
yeah.
if you're a 32-year-old musician in 2019.
Yeah, of course.
If you're even a 40-year-old musician today, hip-hop has been part of your accepted reality, period. Mm-hmm. And in much the same way that you might receive Dwayne Allman guitar solos,
sure,
you will also receive Pete Rock beats.
And I think from a macro historical standpoint, like, jazz spent a lot of time in the, particularly in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, bolstering its credentials
yeah.
and bolstering the systems by which it was passed on. And those tended to be academic, and those tended to be above board. It was basically, to make that a little bit, you know, more direct, there was a lot of money and time and earnest investment put into making sure that there were great jazz studies programs across the country,
yep.
and there were great jazz academies across the
mm-hmm.
country, and there were opportunities for kids to learn this music.
Things with an eye to the 50-year plan,
oh,
to
yeah.
the 100-year.
Exactly, but, yeah. and to the cultural legacy of this music and establishing that there were certain heroics that had gone down in history that wouldn't be forgotten and
yep.
wouldn't be lost. At the same time, it served to divide the music from popular culture in a lot of ways. It served to say that, like, okay, learn these fundamentals as a text. You
it's
know?
Institution music.
Exactly.
It's not living music.
And
or at least in those contexts.
The beautiful thing about that is that you can learn that and then you can integrate it into something a little bit more natural and a little bit more integrated.
Yeah,
itself,
sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's where we're at right now. I mean, there's nobody who's really making this music in a serious way and communicating with listeners that's just satisfied to stay in the academic side. It's really tumbling all out and together in a Spotify universe where, like Martin was saying, the amount of access that we have is just astronomical in terms of our, you know, history, recent history, long ago history. I mean, whether it's an Alan Lomax recording or it's a Roz G record,
mm-hmm.
it's all there for you as a creator, and the greatest musicians are drawing from all of it.
Speaking of someone working in the academy but also outside, we should talk about your number one geo. What album is that?
It's called Diatom Ribbons. It's by Chris Davis.
Oh, although maybe it's not Diatom. We don't
exactly,
know.
Exactly, as we were discussing off mic.
We don't know.
We're not quite sure.
But, you know, it's one of those. Email us if you know. So let's listen to a little bit of Corn Crake. And this is Chris Davis with Terry Lynn Carrington and Val Jonty. So, Gio, one of the things that I was struck by listening to this record, and I think this record was a little tough for me to access, but the kind of, I don't want to say collision, but the bringing together of people who, at least based on your writing about this record, maybe ordinarily wouldn't be in the same room,
right,
or haven't been in the same room. Can you tell me a little bit about these choices?
So, Chris Davis herself is a piano player who's been on the rise in New York for the last 15 to 20 years.
Me too. I've also been on the road for the last 15 or 20 years. And we're almost there.
By contrast, I'm falling. So
hey. Trust me, I'm right behind you. Don't worry. I see you on the way down. That's how
I do it. So she's every jazz enthusiast's big curiosity right about now.
Okay.
Like, okay, what is her next move? And usually she's got multiple next moves. She's playing on six different people's projects at once. She's got a couple of her own things going. She, in the last few years, has started a record label that is what she put this album out through.
She's faculty at Berkeley?
She's a faculty member at Berkeley. Her qualifications are many, and I'm sure I'm leaving some off. But what matters most is that she has this distinctive but also extremely hard to pin down or define way of playing the piano that also becomes a way of composing. And it's really built around a atomic approach, which is where I think she got the name for the album, where she'll build little phrases and then she'll explode them or recast them in a different key. But you'll always, without realizing it necessarily, be hearing some kind of motivic effect over and over and over. And that's why it was so brilliant for her to work with a musician who's not often associated with the avant-garde, Terry Lynn Carrington, the drummer, who has her own way of, I like to think of it as like a prismatic way of drumming, which is like she'll be playing a funk groove, but then she'll turn it on its side a little bit. And it won't be, okay, let me play this groove until you're deeply hypnotized by it. It'll be like, let me disrupt the hypnosis at every turn.
Sure.
That's something that she gets through a long lineage, but I think especially from Jack DeJohnette, her big mentor. And then Val Jonty, who's the turntablist on this record, brilliant Haitian, sort of, I guess you could call her a conceptual turntablist. I mean, she's really got her own approach, and she uses samples on this record, often of spoken word elements from, I shouldn't call it spoken word because it's not really poetry, but samples from interviews and statements from people, especially Olivier Messiaen, the composer who's on this particular track, and Cecil Taylor, the pianist and composer who is a big influence on Chris Davis's piano playing, particularly that kind of heavily rhythmic motivic style I was talking about. So it's an assemblage. It's funk rhythms on both the drums and the piano, kind of screwed up and messed up. It's weird avant-garde bass playing, whether that's actually done by the bassist Trevor Dunn or by the samples on the turntables.
Sure.
It's a lot of commingling of musicians from different worlds, because the core trio is what you mentioned, Carrington, Jonty, and Davis, but there's also a couple of saxophone players who don't usually play together, J.D. Allen, Tony Malaby. There's the avant-garde guitarists, Nels Klein and...
Mark Rebo,
thank you. Ches Smith is a percussionist who's here on vibraphone mostly, I think.
Esperanza
Spalding does vocals, recites a beautiful Gwendolyn Brooks poem, and it's just so many different things coming together. And it's a reminder of something that I hope we can get back to later when we talk about a piece Martin recently put on his personal site about Jason Moran's thing at the Whitney this past year, which is that jazz is and has forever been a music of mixing and assemblage. And that means not only that different source materials being drawn on, like we were talking about before, but also that different people get to exist in their own fullness and in communion at the same time.
Sure.
And that's
and
what's
also,
so cool.
And as we had spoken about previously, not strictly musically.
To me, the significance of this record and the thing that made me think a lot about this record was if this record had been done 10 years ago, you would purely get the Chris referencing Cecil Taylor circa Akisa Kalia, Silent Tongues, and the early 70s. Here's this phrase again. Here's this phrase somewhat abstracted and on. And there is that, but there is so much more. And I think that's a reflection of the times. There's such a great ambition on Davis's part. And I think it kind of plays with her dynamic flow of her discography. Mm. I mean, she does this record where she's doing both a song duet and an improvised duet with many different improvisers. Then she's just doing a straight piano duet record with Craig Taborn, where they do some of his, some of hers, a Carla Bley, a Sun Ra, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's almost like big production. It's just jam. Now, here's something more ambitious again. But still in all, Davis is an enormously important player on the scene. And again, one of these people where, you know, it's a far more complicated answer. What does jazz sound like in 2019? Well, listen to Chris Davis. Problem is you'd be running around a lot. I mean, I love this record, but, you know, my Chris Davis moment happened hearing her as a side woman. She was in the Jonathan Blake group that blew everybody away at the Vanguard. And she was playing Friday, Saturday, Sunday after David Varelis had played on Tuesday, Wednesday, which struck me as, whoa, can I just set up a futon back here?
Right. And I had more people writing to me about that week at the Vanguard than maybe any other last year.
I saw Sunday night and one of the beauties of a Village Vanguard type gig or a multi-night engagement is that the performances evolve set after set after set. I was there for the second set on Sunday night, and there was a moment toward the end where each musician sort of takes a solo, commands, and Desron Douglas, the bassist, had done his, and he'd started into this slightly gospely Memphis funk thing, and then it turns into Chris Davis's turn, and everybody almost stopped because the band wanted to hear what she was going to do too. And she played totally into the house and then brought it into her style. And it was amazing.
I love what you said about the fact that her ambition just continues to grow. And I like that this record allows us to think about personal ambition as not just a personal thing. Because as her ambition grows, she's done something really smart and I think really of the moment, which is to expand her network along with her ambition and to expand her interdependence, her dependence on other collaborators and other people with ideas, as opposed to just putting it all on her shoulders. And I think that's deeply a part of the jazz ethic. And as we move away from a text-oriented and an academy-oriented idea of jazz, which says, here are the great figures, here are the great ideas, have your own too, you know, study that stuff so you can be you. It says, no, actually, it's a huge and amorphous tumbling history of communities and of collaborations. And just free yourself to depend on those around you and to depend on the tradition. And don't say you need to be the next great what, you know. Say, what did that context of invention feel like back then? And how can we emulate something as rich today?
Sure. If you look 80, 90 years ago, you had jazz scenes developing independently in New Orleans, Chicago, Kansas City, that sort of thing. And you have it again today.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the fun of going to the Detroit Jazz Festival or the Chicago Jazz Festival or what, you know,
Hyde Park,
whatever,
in Chicago,
you know, whatever locale you go to isn't to hear the same sort of concert you might hear at Jazz at Lincoln Center. It's to hear all the local cats.
Yeah.
Because they're on their own thing.
Yeah, because it's scenes and contexts more than it's individual figures.
Mm-hmm. You guys are walking me right into the Jason Moran thing. You're walking just pushing me right into it. So Moran has worked cross-discipline with a variety of artists, one of whom is Adrian Piper, correct? Tell me about what they've done together. Anyone, jump on in.
Moran has collaborated with a number of artists, Piper, Carrie Mae Weems, Kara Walker, Joan Jonas. He has sought these collaborations, and he's kind of elicited other people to engage in this dialogue, too. Y'all all know about the Facebook 10, right? Where you get tagged by somebody who wants, and you're supposed to name 10 albums that were meaningful for you as a teenager. Well, Moran plays the Facebook 10 by saying, name 10 artists, or 10 paintings, or 10 installations. I've gotten tagged twice by him, and I'm like, I don't have time for this.
First of all, everybody get off Facebook. Let's listen. So let's listen, before we get into the specifics of the exhibit, let's listen to Jason Moran with Adrian Piper, Gio.
Yeah, this is a piece that he did with her. I don't know if we should call it a tune or what, many years ago, but feels newly relevant. Adrian Piper, who herself had a great retrospective show a couple years ago at the Whitney, they've been working together. She's sort of one of the couple conceptual artists, Joan Jonas being the other, who really unlocked for him his own relationship to conceptual art as a tunnel into jazz history, jazz thinking. Mm-hmm. And this particular piece is called Breakdown, and it's a really great example of their collaboration.
Great. Let's listen to Breakdown.
Breakdown. The barriers. Breakdown. Misunderstanding. Breakdown. The art world. Breakdown. The artists. Breakdown. The general public. Breakdown. Their society. Breakdown. Procedures. Breakdown. Presuppositions. Breakdown. Intentions. Breakdown. Ideas. Breakdown. The barriers. Breakdown. Misunderstanding. Breakdown. The art world. Breakdown. The artists.
So if you had the chance to be in New York, or I guess in a couple other cities, Minneapolis, so Jason Moran
Columbus
just concluded at the Whitney Museum an exhibition that kind of engages with some of the ideas that we've just been talking about. Jason Moran has been around for a very long time, a piano player, and he has had a kind of sustained engagement with artists in other media. And this exhibition thinks about music, but really thinks about music in conversation and how it could be reflected through and reflected within other art forms and through other artists' practices. Gio, can you tell me a little bit about what the room was like? Tell the people, rather, because I was there. Don't tell me. I was there. I saw it.
I think I knew that.
Yes. I didn't get to go to any performances, unfortunately. I did get to check out the exhibit. But can you explain, for folks who didn't get to see it, how it was set up and what the principle, especially coming out of what we were just talking about, contexts, that's really resonant for Jason.
Yeah. So Jason Moran, as you mentioned, is this pianist who is now entering into his third decade as a band leader of note in New York, still feels very much on the cutting edge of what's going on. This exhibition, which, as you mentioned, traveled across the country and came to the Whitney in the fall, involved three installations that he had first built. I think the two of the three he had first built for the Venice Biennale a few years ago. They were recreations, not quite life-size, but big enough to step into, literally, of old jazz stages from New York City. There was the Savoy Ballroom, there was Slug's Saloon, and there was the Three Deuces. All of those
from different time periods.
Exactly. Also, right. The Savoy is from the swing era in the 30s, 40s. Three Deuces is from the bebop era, which directly followed, and then Slug's Saloon is from the 70s, really, sort of the heyday of post-bop avant-garde in New York City. But that wasn't it. He also had what he would call, I think, drawings that were made through a variety of means. Some of them were picking up the residue of his fingertips on the keyboard and created what looked like a David Hammons basketball drawing.
They were sort of long and thin, the length of the keyboard.
Exactly.
And so it is quite literally the...
The remnants, exactly.
Right.
And then there were some video installations, including one that lasted for, I think it was 6 hours, and that was done with Stan Douglas, the conceptual artist. It was in its own little room
okay.
off to the side. It takes a while to explain, and maybe Martin can explain it for us a little later, but it was a sort of a rendering of what Miles Davis's Live Evil sessions, I think, were like back in the 70s, but then turned into their own experience. The bottom line is just that Jason Moran is putting jazz into conversation in a bolder and bigger way than many people have done before, with other mediums of artistic expression. But it's not just that he's saying, I'm a conceptual artist as well as a musician and I like to work across media, because that's something that we can grasp now and
yeah.
a lot of people do. But he's saying that when you do that, you get a lot more physicality. Your body is in this space with this present experience, whether that's listening to a recording that you can then actually kind of see the visual element accompanying it, or whether it's, okay, I'm stepping into a quote-unquote sculpture that's actually a jazz stage that actually carries decades of history within it and that can also be activated in the present moment by a band playing.
And you saw, which is when you wrote about it, you saw about him starting on one stage in one style,
right.
stepping off into another stage
yep.
and adjusting on the fly.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so that's something I should mention is that these stages weren't just idle sculptures. They were activated first by the bandwagon in a gallery show opening performance, and then with a series of performances by other jazz bands that he invited to come in and play on those stages. So really what he's doing to me is he's saying jazz's history is embodied and it's physical as much as it's able to be documented either on paper or in recordings. So that has subtly a lot of political messaging associated with it, which is to say you can't just collect the records and you can't just collect the memories and the histories. You've also got to remember that there was a physical and a social engagement
yeah,
around this music in these spaces that gave it its importance.
Right, and it revivifies not just the spaces, but the people who were in the spaces, both
exactly.
presenting the music and also absorbing the music as listeners or dancers or whatnot.
Which, to make a somewhat self-serving leap to a piece that I wrote, not for the Times, but for the Atlantic, it's the reason, what you just described, is the reason why I thought of Saidiya Hartman's new book, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, which is a recentering of basically underdocumented or undocumented or misdocumented lives by young black women moving into American cities in the early part of the 20th century. She goes into the archive in a way that Jason Moran often does when he does his little historical excursions in search of inspiration, in search of information, in search of his next project. And Saidiya Hartman, who also happened to win a MacArthur grant just a few months ago, decided to use the broken histories that we have through the documents of, you know, social reformers or psychiatrists who are misdiagnosing, you know, young black women coming to the cities and saying they're social pariahs, essentially. And she said, actually, there's a huge social history that we're not even aware of here. And when I saw Jason Moran's presentation at Carnegie Hall, which he put together in collaboration with the operatic mezzo-soprano Alicia Hall Moran, his wife, it was also sort of an examination of the history of the Great Migration in the early part of the 20th century and middle part of the 20th century through uncovering and dredging up a lot of music that was not necessarily in the canon yet or in Carnegie Hall yet, but deserved to be. And so by taking that physical kind of claiming of space to Carnegie Hall and that claiming of this historical memory through music, he was saying, like, we need to remember that history is about all kinds of people and it's about all kinds of assembly and it doesn't always get documented, but it could, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's the message
sure.
that I think if we're going to treat jazz as a historical artifact, which it often is, we should remember that there was a lot of stuff that wasn't necessarily written into the first or second draft of history.
That we have to recover.
And here he is doing that.
So, Martin, you also wrote about the Marancho. You wrote about it on your blog. Tell people what your blog's called.
Rotations.wordpress.com.
So, on Rotations, you were talking about one of the things that this exhibit does is this kind of, I think, I don't know if whose word was smudging. One of y'all's word was smudging.
That was
me. Okay. But
I was going off Martin.
Going off Martin, yeah. So, Martin, tell me a little bit about what you took away from the Marancho.
Well, there were two things that I took away. I mean, one of them I actually wrote, and the other one,
you saved for us.
Exactly. Because, you know, this is often why I don't blog, because I'll post it and then I'll keep thinking about it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, 5 days later, I'm like, oh, why did I write that?
Also, but you can't give all the sauce away for free. You can't
but
give all that drip away.
No, but okay, so the Moran thing was super important, I think, because it invites us to think about jazz differently. And, you know, bringing in what I've thought about since then, it's inviting us to lose the paranoia.
What does that mean?
For the last 50 years, part of being a fan of jazz is worrying whether it's going to continue to exist. Well, clearly, if jazz has survived what has happened in popular culture over the last 50 years, and yet, for one, you have jazz musicians headlining stages at Coachella and Bonnaroo. You have jazz musicians, you know, collaborating with the leading hip-hop producers of our time. You have jazz musicians in every phase of every academic institution that's invested in culture. It's here. It's going to be here. So instead of fighting for its presence, let's utilize its presence to integrate and expand. And that's what Moran is doing. He's expanding into conceptual, visual, creative arts fields. He's inviting other artists to follow through on their ambitions as well. And he's inviting us as an audience to see the parallels so that, yes, I see, you know, I see Chris Davis as an advancement of Cecil Taylor in a way, but maybe it's useful to think, how does that work relative to Kurosawa and Wong Kar-wai?
All right, so here's a question that I was left with after the Marancho. So, and I think you guys have alluded to this and maybe not said it outright. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but tell me that Moran is actively seeking these sorts of collaborations. He's actively going out and saying, I want to work with such and such conceptual artists, such and such. And part of that is personal, his own artistic journey, but also some of that is historical and advocacy work of him wanting to help expand where jazz's footprint can be taken seriously. That's the first part. If I'm full of nonsense, okay.
You're not wrong.
Save it for after the
they're
second
part. They're asking to work for them too, though.
That's my question.
Exactly.
How much of this is him wanting to put jazz in conversation with those people, and how much of it is those people wanting to be in conversation with jazz?
So I spoke to Adrian Edwards, who's the brilliant curator of performance at the Whitney, who put together this show with Jason Moran. And she said, I noticed that all these artists, Glenn Ligon, Joan Jonas, Adrian Piper, had themselves actively sought out working with him.
Okay.
And I wanted to know why. And she said, I finally found that it wasn't something super distinguishable about his style or his sound or even his mentality necessarily. She said it was a feeling that they wanted, that he had in his work, that they wanted to put into theirs. I sort of at first rebelled against that because it felt too wishy-washy and it felt almost like a diminishing of what Moran's doing just to call it a feeling. But then I realized she's trying to basically say something too big to say. He's doing so much in his work that he's able to wrap his arms around so much history and so much conviction. He really has an idea of what he's trying to accomplish, and it involves an ethic of collaboration that is inborn in jazz. It involves a long historical memory that's inborn in jazz. It involves the ruggedness and the contingency of improvisation. It involves the relationship to time that jazz can have that visual art can't have. So there's all these things that he's so good at manipulating, and he's hungry for the kind of inspiration that these visual artists can give him because they're not boxed in the way that a lot of people who come out of the Jazz Academy are.
Yep.
They are quote-unquote conceptualists, not to say they're really pretentious and up their own, you know, ass doing their own thing. For him, conceptualist means I get to just imagine. I just get to, like, break stuff down, you know, as Adrian Piper says in that piece, as opposed to following the rules, worshiping the idols. He said that Adrian Piper told him once that she's always trying to dismantle the grid. And I think that's a really good way to look at what he's trying to do with jazz.
Oh, for sure. Going back maybe 10, 12 years ago, if you were just to stumble into Jazz Standard one night where Moran and Bandwagon were playing, you know, they might all come out, and then and he would pull out a little MP3 player or something to that effect and start playing a Polish broadcast of a soccer game with all the interesting vocal rhythms and excitement that comes from sportscasting, and then he'll pick a figure and riff off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nasheed Waits would riff off of his figure. And then Taras Mateen would dive in with a bass line and so on and so forth. And by the middle of the tune, the sportscast is gone, but here's this piece that they've more or less combusted on the spot. And that was Moran's way of saying that jazz is about sound. In all sound, you know, it's not just 12-bar blues or whatever. Yeah.
Does place have the same meaning in your guys' mind today that it did in the eras that the Moran show sort of calls back to?
No, because I think we live in the ether a lot more, right? Through our screens. Our screens are not really a place at all.
Easy, Jenny O'Dell. Easy.
Yeah, I mean,
follow me on Instagram, please. Please, I need the attention.
Or, you know, you could call me Baudrillard 50 years ago.
Sure. I mean,
I'm not being particularly original with that whole idea, but it's definitely a trend that we need to both accept and probably push back against a little bit. And I think that's Moran's point, is that if we allow it to get so conceptual that it's just able to be, you know, condensed into words or ideas, so to speak, then we're losing the physicality. And that's really where the power comes. I mean, bodies in motion, bodies, you know, in collaboration. And I think it's about the people and the physicality of the people doing this stuff that makes place important. And that's his point.
He wanted his Fats Waller record not to be, oh, it's a tribute to Fats Waller. He wanted people to get up and dance. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he presented at Harlem Stage, there weren't seats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And similarly, in bringing people in, the James Reese Europe thing was exactly about that sort of thing. But yeah, and Two Wings, the, you know, this is starting to put the entire context of 20th century African America into a broader picture that, if not jazz, is at least jazz adjacent.
Two Wings being the show that they did at Carnegie Hall.
Yes, exactly.
Let's transition a little bit. Gio, you wrote a piece earlier this year. You're talking about Moore Mother, Angel Batjaweed, Ben Lamar Gay, Melanie Charles. You were sort of pointing towards Afrofuturism in that piece and what's feeling like an emergent or maybe reemergent sensibility. We've been talking a lot about people who are, I don't want to say not satisfied with kind of jazz as it's been presented or historicized or whatever, but I did feel in the music of the people who you wrote about this kind of restlessness, this kind of, I don't want to say discomfort, but certainly moving in that direction with maybe what they've been handed and maybe wanting to push harder at the musical margins. Can you tell me a little bit about what made you bring that group of artists together and what are the kind of broader themes of the last couple of years that have led us to this moment where that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there.
You take an hour. It's cool. No problem.
It was this idea that the word jazz or the idea of jazz history is only one element in a much broader tumult, you know, and that at the same time, these musicians do have certain ambitions about human power, about the power of the collective, of the power of memory, of repatriating some memories that have been suppressed, and of just plain artistic expression and innovation that goes way beyond what's codified or circumscribed into a genre or into even a medium. All of that is essential to the work of these musicians. And by that, I mean they're not even musicians necessarily. They're poets, visual artists, video artists, improvising instrumentalists, singers, pretty much everybody on that list is all of those things.
It's polyvalent. Yeah, I think the word that I was sort of struggling for a minute ago was like there's something fundamentally insufficient about what they had been handed.
Right.
And using these tools that you're talking about to either improve upon, expand upon,
right.
grow the boundaries of what's on the table. The insufficiency is kind of what I came away from.
And here's a positive way of framing that insufficiency. I had just seen Moor Mother, who I hope we can play this
Let's play a Moor Mother song right now.
Why don't we play Black Flight by Moor Mother, a track that features Saul Williams from the album she released in 2019. The album's called Analog Fluids of Sonic Black Holes, and it ain't jazz. I mean, that's mm-hmm. obvious, mm-hmm. but it's also not any particular other genre. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to it.
All right, let's listen to it a little bit.
I found my face in the rat race, made it off the planet in a space race. I found my face, not lighter than a paper bag, I caught a case. My father got the balls in a slave chase, prison chase, freedom race. I've been replaced, memory erased, no case.
Yo.
Black flight, gotta get away. Black flight, gotta get away.
Black flight, black wings, black light, black dreams. Dark matter chaos theory, the invention of the zero, mathematical compromise, time served, carceral capitalism, maroon colonies on Martian mountaintops, pyramid schemes, spiral dynamics, chakra centers and the octave scale, seven notes, seven holes, 7 days, seven fears, mythical landscapes, zinc and black capes draped in eternity, suddenly turned to see my own self looking at me, approach the mirror, delete the error, shift gears, light years, mental magnetism.
And Pedro in the ether, drop 10 seconds of Saul Williams on Coded Language from 1999, just to see the kind of long arc that we're dealing with right now.
Whereas breakbeats have been the missing link connecting the diaspora community to its drum-woven past. Whereas the quantized drum has allowed the whirling mathematicians to calculate the ever-changing distance between rock and stardom. Whereas the velocity of spinning vinyl cross-faded, spun backwards and re-released at the same given moment of recorded history, yet at a different moment in time's continuum, has allowed history to catch up with the...
Back in the present, or maybe the future, Moor Mother.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's...
See what I did?
It's a continuum.
It seemed silly, but it wasn't.
And it's not only that historical continuum, it's also what Martin alluded to in that blog post that he put up about Jason Moran and what we've been discussing before. It's that flow between media. And I think I felt it really strongly toward the beginning of this year. I had just seen Moor Mother perform with a more jazz-oriented group. She's backed by a jazz quartet. It's called Irreversible Entanglements. Full disclosure, I'm a close friend of one of the musicians in it, but I gotta mention it. And I was in Chicago at the Midwinter Festival, not a jazz festival, at the Art Institute of Chicago. And one of the galleries had a Dawood Bey exhibition called Night Comes Tenderly Black. And it's photographs that I don't fully remember how he does this, but they're very, very, very darkly black and gray tinted. And they're photographs of places along the Underground Railroad route, from the route that enslaved people would use to get away to the north in the mid-1800s. And I had this palpable feeling as if I was listening to Moor Mother again, looking at these deep, dark, forested images of... Basically, that we're trying to convey flight, the fear of having, you know, hellhounds on your trail, quite literally, but also this sense that, okay, this is only a way station. We're going somewhere. We're getting out and kind of out of that darkness, you know, post Tenebris Lux, like out of the darkness. Perhaps there will be a light. And that's what Moor Mother said to me in our interview for this article mm-hmm. was, and that's the only time I used that word Afrofuturism, was yeah. at the end of the article quoting her. She said, I'm an Afrofuturist because I'm not negative about this stuff. I do believe that out of all the darkness and all of the terrible stuff I, you know, write my poetry about, something new is coming. And it was that feeling of forward momentum in the darkness
yeah.
of Dawood Bey's images, as well as in the kind of hyper-excited beats that she makes that I felt a commonality there.
Sure. Martin, did any of the musicians in this space really move you this year?
They move me in general. I mean, a lot of this actually reminds me of things that I used to play on the radio a long, long time ago because...
What era specifically?
Oh, in the 80s.
Yep.
Because it's of a piece of mostly African Americans finding the available definitions insufficient and looking for ways of using artistic tools to expand that, announce the expansion, and moving forward.
Right. Coming to a close of this conversation, I did want to talk about one musician who I learned about from Geo's List, and that is Joel Ross. Joel Ross plays vibraphone. He had a record this year. It's called Kingmaker. I thought this record was a banger,
mm-hmm.
a smooth banger.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. I felt like there was almost like an unconscious elegance to it. And I was struck by how easy it was for me to get absorbed inside of it and at the same time be like kind of like woken up by it.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to everything on your list. And I listened to a bunch of stuff that Martin had written about as well. This was the only record that really worked that way for me.
Wow.
I'd be really curious to know more about him. You guys earlier said he plays a lot and he's gigging right now. This record is an old, these are self-recorded?
Basically, yeah.
So yeah, talk me through it.
So, I mean, Joel Ross is one of these just preternatural synthesizers. Like, he takes history and he takes the present moment and it all just kind of bundles together and comes out, like you said, kind of in this really cool stream of ideas, of sound. He's one of those guys, like, I mean, this record reminds me more than anything else that has come out recently of Roy Hargrove in the 90s because it does that thing where it is... nominally, quite idiomatically, jazz, contemporary jazz, down the center. Like, everybody in the jazz world is like, yep, he's got the chops. Yep,
yep,
he's hitting the notes. Like, he's doing it exactly as you would be taught you ought to do it in school. And then he's just flying beyond. And you can't even say how or why. I mean, he's not breaking the mode in a way that's so conspicuous. He's not, like, saying...
It's not avant.
It's not an avant-garde send-up of anything in particular, but he's just got an original way of playing the vibraphone that's rooted in Milt Jackson and Bobby Hutcherson, the two great pillars of vibraphone in the mid-20th century. And he's got a funk and hip-hop influenced flow that also is deeply still swinging in a jazz way. So, Martin, I mean, yeah. how do you define... the force that has come on the scene in the last three years.
Well, the thing I like about when I listen to Joel Ross is what associations I make. And sure, there are all kinds of references that suggest Bobby Hutcherson or Milt Jackson or Red Norvo even. But then when I saw him at Jazz Gallery 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, recently, one of the two things that struck me was his first solo, the musician that came to mind was Grand Poobah. You know, just in the way he flowed.
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
You know, the thing is I'm a fan of Joel Ross. I may be a big fan of Joel Ross, but I'm not 100% sold yet because I feel like the movie's just starting.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot more, especially as he evolves as a composer and that sort of thing. But the other thing that totally, completely blew me away at that Jazz Gallery show was aside from the fact that it was completely, totally sold out, I'd say half the crowd wasn't a jazz crowd. One of the things that I have immense amounts of fun with is I'm out often enough that, you know, I can smell jazz on people. And
that is so,
you know,
unfortunate and so true.
One of the things, you know, there are certain musicians. Darcy James Argue is another. His crowd, you know, you might be waiting to get into one of his shows and they're talking about going to the Ring Cycle or something like that. He attracts a non-jazz crowd. The people I saw at Joel Ross were people that I saw at Gary Clark at Celebrate Brooklyn or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of crowd. I mean, it's as if, you know, I don't think there's a Joel Ross Tiny Desk concert, but it was a Tiny Desk crowd.
Yeah, there ought to be. And, I mean, that's really going to be essential for the music going forward. We talked a little bit about jazz being engaged in that kind of super important process of breaking down its own boundaries,
mm-hmm.
which at all the great moments for the music, it's been doing. But for a few decades, it was more concerned about building its own boundaries than
mm-hmm.
breaking them down.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you look at the audience at a lot of jazz shows, as you mentioned, Martin, that's a huge problem, that you can tell that most of the cats in the crowd are also musicians themselves or have been in some way raised within the music. And there are a lot of artists nowadays who are breaking out of that. One of them is also, similarly to Joel Ross, a rising musician who, with roots in Chicago, now based in New York, Marquise Hill, who also put out a great record this year, and a record that actually, unlike Joel Ross's, does not check all the boxes to be called a contemporary jazz record. It's called Love Tape, and it's much more almost like a beat tape. And it, like many other records these days in jazz, uses clips of words spoken to convey messages that give you something a little more tangible to hold on to. But also, you know, once in a while, Josh Johnson, the alto sax player, or Marquise Hill himself, the trumpeter, will break out with a dazzling solo. So yeah, I think that because the music itself is escaping its own sort of shadow, you know, like dancing outside of whatever boundaries are around that, the crowd is following and the media that cover the music is following. I mean, Joel Ross's record got not a best new music, but it got a warm review from Pitchfork that I'm sure made a big difference.
Sure.
And that's happening more and more, too.
I'm going to do a little bit of year-end wrapping up after this, but let's go out with something off this Joel Ross record. Let's listen to Ill Relations. Before we close out the episode, I know it's early 2020, but I did want to talk a little bit about 2019. Been a very enjoyable year for Popcast, and I've been really grateful for all the feedback and the emails and the tweets and the Instagram messages, etc. Popcast doesn't happen alone, so I wanted to take a moment to kind of talk about the folks who were involved. I want to thank John Pareles, our chief pop music critic, Joe Coscarelli, our pop music reporter, Karen Gans, our pop music editor, who are frequent guests, and Popcast Gang knows them well. I want to talk about Pedro Rosado, who is not here today, but Pedro is our faithful producer and is behind making me look presumably better than I ordinarily look. Actually, Dan is in the room today, and Brad is not in the room, but Dan and Brad help on the back end, and I'm always grateful for that. Shouts to Gilbert, who runs Culture, who's a big Popcast listener. What up, Gilbert? I kind of worry sometimes about the state of criticism, and I get anxious about, is the internet undermining the possibility for strong critical writing, contrarian critical writing, writing that is not designed to make you liked on the internet. And so I always worry with each new year of Popcast, like, are there going to be new folks that I can have on the show? And I put together a list of everybody who was on the show this year, and I want to say at least half, it was their first time. And I was really, really excited to have all these folks on this year. So just to read real quick: Teddy Blanks, Eduardo Cepeda, Brian X. Chen, Brett Clarkson, Naima Cochran, Cam Collins, Ben Dandridge Lemko, Jim DeRogatis, talking about Hootie, of all things, Sydney Ember, Eli Enos, Susie Exposito, Larry Fitzmaurice, Megan Garvey, Hannah Georges, Jason Green, Aisha Harris, Hunter Harris, Rob Arvilla, Caroline Haskins, Isabella Herrera, Amanda Hess, Charles Holmes, Shannon Houchins, Hassan James, Jeff Johnson, Sebastian Jones, Christian Yunsu Kim, Ron Lieber, Robert Maravich, Evelyn McDonald, Wesley Morris, Keith Murphy, Murph, Andrew Nosnitsky, Amanda Petrusich, Al Pierre, Ben Ratliff, Jody Rosen, Milena Rizik, A.O. Scott,
Maria Sherman, Ramez Cilian, Ben Cesario, Danielle Smith, Jay Smooth, Tim Summer, Fraser Tharp, David Turner, Andrew Unterberger, Elizabeth Vincentelli, Jada Watson, Nick Weidenfeld, Jonah Weiner, Natalie Weiner, Brianna Younger, Lindsay Zolads, all on Popcast in 2019. The state of Popcast is strong, even stronger this year. Thank you to Martin and to Gio for coming on today. Our producers are Pedro Rosado from Head Separate Media and Dan Powell in the room today. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me, podcast@nytimes.com, any questions you have. And if you have a question about jazz, I'll forward it to someone who knows the answer. Let's go out with a little bit of hip-hop jazz as it used to be, not as it is today, but as it once was. This is off the Jazz Mataz record that Guru put out. Let's listen to Loungin' with Donald Byrd.